This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 123, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases, and other related events. If you want to hear the extended version of this interview, which is about an extra 24 minutes, please join the Patreon campaign. You can get a 7-day free trial, where you get access to more than 100 episodes in the back catalogue. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. This week I'm talking to Steve Neal about his book, But Something Is There. Steve Neal is a special effects makeup artist, filmmaker, puppeteer, model maker and visual effects artist in film and television with a career spanning over 35 years. He's worked on many movies including Star Trek The Motion Picture, where he made Spock's ears, Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, Ghostbusters, Fright Night, and many other sci-fi and horror films. He has had encounters with ETs throughout his life. He has the YouTube channel Breaking the Silence, which features his ET experiences. I started talking to Steve before we were recording the episode, and it was such a good flowing conversation, I just hit the record button. We were talking about letters received from people who have had alien abduction experiences.
It's kind of like Whitley Strieber's communion letters. The same kind of, we get them all the time.
Well, I remember Whitley talking about that and how his wife read something like 10,000 letters. And
yeah, she did too.
And I think she said something like, the more bizarre it is, the more likely she is to believe it. And also, whatever's happening has got some kind of connection to the afterlife. Or I think she said yes. To death.
Yeah, she did say that. And, you know, I've experienced myself and heard many people tell things that are just so incredibly crazy that no one will believe them. And that I think that's the idea. And you asked about the connection between the visitors, for lack of a better term, and the other side, the afterlife, the realm of the dead. I don't like that term because I don't think anything ever dies. But yeah, there's absolutely a connection. And we have the same connection as beings ourselves, and we just are unaware of it. We've been told we don't have one, that things like that are silly, they don't exist, and it's caused us a lot of harm. It never caused the indigenous people of this world any harm.
And it's also something where it seems that nobody will step up and do the research. No psychologists, no universities, no scientists. They almost, I think, will see it as a career suicide to really start studying the alien abduction phenomenon. Do you think that's right?
It is. I mean, if you take the astronomer that took the Betty Hill map and made a physical model of the star system in the general area that they've described that they were from. I mean, from what I understand, her career was destroyed, as many people's are. I mean, if you first of all, it's typical in science when somebody comes along with a new idea like continental drift, you stone them to death. You know, it's like that scene in Monty Python. He said Jehovah, and that's true all the way through. And then eventually they come to terms with it. They find out, oh, geez, there really is continental drift. It wasn't a crazy idea. But with this, with the UFO phenomenon and people having encounters with the occupants, it seems that there's been a lot of hard work put into discrediting anybody that comes forward honestly with real data or real information or real studies or experiences from this to just absolutely destroy them. And in my experience, especially back during the 90s, like many other people in the field, if we didn't stop, then they would start putting on the clamps on you. They would start doing things like they did to me. They started sending me threatening letters from the CIA and the NSA. And they would also stalk us, scare the hell out of my wife, who demanded I get out of the whole thing because she was so frightened by it. But the worst thing they did was send literally people describe to me, not they didn't the people in the studio didn't say they were men in black, but they described them as being dressed in black and having ID badges and coming in and saying that I was a criminal and it wasn't in their best interest to keep working with me. They really go out on a limb to destroy people, even kill them. And I really, I have strong feelings about Dr. Mack and what happened to him. And I really don't think it was an accident.
Right. Okay.
There were two other John Macks, I understand, killed that same day in being run over.
I hadn't heard that. Because he was at, was it a dinner, wasn't it, in London for the society that is, it was Lawrence of Arabia, wasn't it? He wrote the Pulitzer Prize winning biography.
Right.
And he was in London having dinner, and they say he stepped out onto the road, and because he was American, he looked the wrong way because we drive on the left.
Mm-hmm.
But you think there was more to it?
A lot of us do, but we can't be sure. You know, that's the problem with it, but it's very suspicious because they tried to take him down. I mean, here you have a very distinguished PhD like himself from Harvard. Harvard tried to take him down. They couldn't do it.
Yeah, I think they had to back down, didn't they?
Yeah, they did end up backing down.
Because I kind of saw it was that they were going to remove his tenure, weren't they? And
yes, they were.
And he fought them and it was going to go to court. And then I think he had some high-profile clients who remained anonymous, but they said, no, we're going to come forward and back you up. And it was right. Almost like the court case was about, is abduction real, not should he lose his tenure? And then Harvard backed down, so maybe they got a visit from the men in black.
Who knows? I certainly don't. But, you know, my friend, Dr. Roger Lehr, they messed with him too. They went after him, the medical board, and tried to, his license was in question. He wasn't performing the surgeries. He was getting licensed surgeons to perform the implant surgeries. I was there present. And so was Whitley. And we were always present at those surgeries and everything was done by the book. And these people had no scars at all. And yet there were objects under their skin. And when they were pulled out and analyzed, they really were very unknown in material and substance. Not to mention, where do they come from? So I'm being careful here because there are a lot of other things that were found out about those implants that didn't make sense. So,
yeah. And you had an x-ray, didn't you, on your arm?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, so what happened there?
That x-ray, you know, when Roger died, that was it. None of us could get to anything. He had the x-rays, he had the implants. I don't know what happened to any of that stuff. So,
but it looked like you had a broken arm, didn't it?
Yeah, but it really wasn't like a break. It looked like my arm had been severed deliberately at a 45 degree angle. The bones. It wasn't a ragged break. It was a very clean line.
Yeah, almost like a really sharp knife had gone through, or a laser or something.
Yeah.
But you don't have any memories of anything happening to you, whether with ETs or otherwise?
Oh, I have plenty, but I don't have anything that deals. I mean, that was a complete mystery to me. I went there to have my arm x-rayed. Roger wanted to x-ray it because he thought there was an implant in my arm. So that's what they did. They, you know, x-ray it. I wasn't going to have it removed, but I was curious. And so we did an x-ray. He had to leave. It was evening. The x-ray tech was staying late to do this for Roger, and Roger left. And then, I waited around to see the x-ray, and he brought it out, developed and put it on the light screen and said, "How did you get this? You must have been in terrible pain." I said, "I don't know what you're talking about." He said, "No, your arm was broken very badly." And I looked at it, and all I could see were this perfect 45-degree angle line running through it. I was surprised he didn't question why it was so clean, but he didn't. And he just said that that your arm's been broken. And I said, look, I'm telling you, I've never broken a bone in my life. I've sprained ankles. I've done all that kind of stuff. I've never broken my arm. And he got annoyed with me. He felt that I was not being truthful with him and asked me to leave.
And also, there was no scarring, was there? It's not like a break that severe might have caused some scarring on your arm.
So it's occurred to me that I could get it x-rayed again, and I might, but I'm not trying to prove anything, you know, and I might do it out of curiosity if it's convenient. I do have a very close doctor friend. He might be able to have it done, and then I'd have another x-ray of it. But then, you know, the weird thing about it is I wouldn't be a bit surprised if nothing showed up.
Yeah, and you wonder why. Maybe the ETs are watching you.
What did somebody do that to you know? I mean, we're dealing with, if we're to believe it, we're dealing with a race of beings so advanced that it's possible that they could have by now erased any evidence of that. Melt, you know, got the stitching to be so perfect that it won't be detected. Who knows? I don't. No, I do have an implant in my ear like Whitley has, and I'm not having that removed. And you can see it quite well when I point it out. Although when Whitley went to feel it, it wasn't there. And when we were driving back after the event later on, my ear was burning and sore, and I felt, and it was back again. So they do move. His did in his ear. So I think when he went to put his fingers on it, it had moved because it wasn't there. And it could have gone down deeper into the softer tissue where we couldn't feel it. It's not. It's about the size of a grain of rice.
And is it in the ear lobe or more of
towards
the skull?
No, it's not. It's up. It's up here. It's up. About midway.
Oh, that's interesting. I've got something in my ear. There's a lump there, and the doctor felt it and said she thought it was some cartilage or something. But what was odd, I just talk about myself for a little second.
I'm sure.
I was interviewing a medium, and we stopped the recording, and she suddenly stops. She goes, oh, you've been tagged. She said, I've just got an image in my mind. You know how ranchers might tag their cows and they put a tag in their ear? She said, you've been tagged in your ear. And I was thinking, I didn't mention anything about ETs or stuff to her, but she picked that out somehow.
Was she plain, very straightforward?
Yeah. I'd just done a whole interview with her and we talked all about her and mediumship and how all that works. So we weren't talking about UFOs or ETs. It was, she just suddenly said that, which is it's interesting. It doesn't mean that I think I've definitely got an implant or something, but
well, no, of course not.
But it's interesting.
I'm just finishing up the show. Every Saturday night we have a premiere of a new show, and it can run anywhere from 10 minutes to 20 minutes long. And generally for the algorithms, I keep it down to around 15, because then people actually watch them all the way through. They'll watch them because they're short. I have time for that. I have found when we do the much longer shows that they don't get watched as much. People watch it later when I have time, and they never do. So the part I'm at, one of the parts I'm at right now is where I went to this psychic fair in West LA back in the 70s. And it was very surprising when I went to it. A friend of mine talked me into going. At this point in time, I had seen plenty of UFOs. I've had plenty of experiences with UFOs, but not the occupants that I could recall. So for me, I just had a lot of sightings. I didn't think I was involved. That didn't happen until much later when Communion came out, and then Whitley and I became friends. So I had an interest in the paranormal, always did. You know, I had seen a ghost with my grandfather, and I could hear them talking to me and things like that. So I went, and there was just this lady. She was quite attractive, I think mid-40s, and very plain, white shirt, sitting at a table. There wasn't anything on the table. I said, you're doing readings? And she says, yeah. And she is psychic. So So I sat down and she looked at me and then she just took my hands and she closed her eyes. And that was it. I mean, she looked at me for 1 second, you know, didn't know anything about me, took my hands and her eyes popped open, kind of shocked. And she said, "You don't belong here. You're not from here." And then she went on to describe this whole amazing event that took place where she felt what she was seeing was like the lines of Nazca in Peru. And she felt that if I went there, I'd feel a connection. And she saw fire and explosions coming from the sky. And I was standing next to some spacecraft that I was very proud of, she said. Very, very proud of the ship. And then the ground opened up and the ship went in and you've been trapped here ever since. And she also, you know, I was quite young at the time and working in Hollywood, and I was hanging around a lot of people that in show business that didn't have my interest. I'm trying to be kind. They didn't have my interest and they didn't have my perspective and they weren't amateur astronomers and they didn't pay attention to science and they were really sort of people that were average. And she asked me, and she knew about them, and she asked me why I spent time with them. She said, "It wasn't good for you." That always stuck with me because I didn't even open my mouth to her about anything. So, and of course, the show that's going up Saturday is expressing why I think some of us are being... why we're having encounters with the beings and why they have the right to do what they've been doing with us. I'm answering that question strictly in my opinion, not as anything that anyone has to believe. It's just, I've been asked over and over again, why is this happening? And so I decided to go ahead and get that over with before we continue on. So
can you just tell the listeners how they can see your videos? Where do they find you?
Well, it's a YouTube channel called Breaking the Silence. And if you do a search for it, you know, you'll find quite a few. So it's best to just use my name, Breaking the Silence, UFOs in the search, and it'll pop right up. We've had over 500,000 views, and we really have only been active since about the first of the year. We're up to about 7,000, going on 8,000 subscribers. It's growing exponentially. Live streams that we do, we've accumulated a lot of people, mostly from the UK and Australia, as a matter of fact, that have these experiences and they have nowhere to go and talk openly about what's happening to them, and still not be public. And so they use different names and they hide their identities, 90% of them, because they're worried about their jobs and they're worried about their families finding out about it. But as you can imagine, you know, having these experiences and they're so dramatic and so life-changing and you have no one to talk to about it, you can't go to the psychologist down the street. She's going to prescribe you medication and tell you that, you know, this does not fit into their paradox at all. And they know that, so they won't even try that. They are able to come here and talk and share their stories and talk to other people like themselves, and it's formed a nice community, and it's really helping them a great deal. Plus, some of them are connecting with Yvonne Smith, who's a certified hypnotherapist here in Southern California that I've been working with since 1989. We've known each other that long, and she's still doing hypnotherapy. And she now can, a lot of the hypnotherapists are doing it over Zoom so they can accommodate people that are not local.
I take people through past life regression. That's my.
Oh, do you?
That's what I do for a living with the hypnotherapy.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Fascinating. Yeah. Well, I have, that's part of it too. It really is. And my strongest past life memory without having regression or working in any other way, by just my sense, is the 40s, World War II, being in the UK, being around B-17s, When I watch Band of Brothers and shows like that, and the Masters of the, was it Masters of the Air or the Masters
of the Masters of the Air, I think it was.
The Air. It's very emotional for me. I mean, I can smell that era. I can smell the planes. I can smell the uniforms, and just, I have such an affinity with it. It's so strong. And I remember when I was a kid growing up, I would, very young, I was having nightmares about the war. Over time, they faded. And I know this is a real marker. But I hesitate to go back and relive it. You know, it may cause me harm in this life. I don't know.
Yeah. And,
I have some feelings about the Civil War too, but nothing is as strong as World War II, because that would have been the last life I had before this one. And so it makes sense that I would have more soul memory about it now, you know, than other ones.
Do you think that there's some connection then between reincarnation and this abduction phenomenon? Because I've heard a couple of times abductees have complained to the ETs and said, you can't do this, you've got no right. And they say something like, well, you agreed to this before you were born.
That's correct. Yeah. Yeah, sure. Yes. Again, that's one of the things I'm answering in the Saturday show. But you know, from what I understand, is it's strictly my gut feeling. You know, the gut feeling you go with when a good example is back in the old days, you get directions to go someplace. Somebody give you directions. And when you get to that point where you had to go left or right, it says clearly left. But you have this feeling that if you go that way, you're going to get lost. And every time you followed the directions, you got lost. And you say to yourself, I knew it was right. And that gut feeling, that sense we all have, is really quite accurate at times. And mine tells me from years of this experience that we go on, we do get reincarnated. Even that expression kind of bothers me, but we do have other lives. But what these people seem to be objecting to is being brought back here again and again and again and again. I remember when I was talking to my friend Robert Salas, who's quite known for his experience being in the silo with the Minuteman missiles and having a UFO above the silo, shutting them all down. He's been on a lot of shows recently, and he's got a book out about what happened. And he's a neat guy. He lives close by, and I mean, we see each other all the time. We started talking about the fact that a lot of us don't feel like we belong here, or that we were originally from here, that we could remember a different life, more advanced, more evolved, than the technological and cultural levels that we're at now here in this world. And he even said he remembers standing in his crib saying, oh, not here again. And then when he says that, the other people listening say, well, I wasn't going to say anything, but I had the same feeling. And it's getting around. A lot of people are starting to come forward and saying that they also felt like they didn't belong here. I really remember quite clearly my first day in school, and sitting in the classroom and looking around at the other kids and listening to the teacher, and it just felt wrong to me. I didn't feel like I was one of them. In fact, in the show, I talk about, and it'll be interesting to see how other people react to it, but I said, you know, just watching Pinocchio terrified me as a kid, the bad boys being turned into donkeys. Island of Dr. Moreau, Planet of the Apes was another one that just, you know, made my skin crawl to think that, you know, we could end up taking our spacecraft to another world and crashing and just ending up being stripped of our culture, our civilization, and being perceived as animals by another race of beings was really humiliating. And I could never understand when I saw films like that or read stories like that, why it affected me and made me feel so uncomfortable it never occurred to me, maybe that's what's been happening to us. Maybe that other life we're remembering didn't have anything to do with this world, this life. And you hear people say they want to go home. Oh, it's tricky. It's hard to articulate. It's hard to talk about. It's hard to express. But so much of it is kind of a visual thing in your mind, and it's very difficult to use this language to express it. I find that difficult.
Yeah, and you've done so much work in Hollywood, building all these things, and
yeah,
I can see behind you. I think it's a Starship Enterprise and 2001, and you've got the face from Communion.
Oh, yeah.
Is it perhaps where you might have felt drawn to doing this kind of work because of your experiences, or it's just the way?
I think that's very possible because as far back as I can remember, when I was a kid, you know, all the other kids wanted to play baseball and football and do sports and things like that. I wanted a telescope. I wanted model rockets. I wanted to watch space shows. I wanted to spend all my time at night outside looking at the stars. I wanted to spend all my time when I would stay at my grandmother's. Both of them lived in the country and deep in the woods. And I spent all my time out in the woods by myself, which was a very dangerous thing to do, looking back on now, connecting with nature. Watching every bug that moved and lizard and just marveling in all of it. I felt most comfortable in the natural setting like that. So, and I felt the stars were my home, and I wanted desperately to get back out there. So you could imagine what happened to me when I saw Star Trek. You know, it's like, yeah, this is it. Working on Star Trek, which is, got to be friends and know Gene Roddenberry, which was amazing. I'm sure it was just coincidence, right?
But you're saying that being out in the woods by yourself might have been dangerous. But actually, it seems like the visitors, they can get you anywhere. It doesn't matter whether you're in the woods or you're in the school.
Well, that's not what I was afraid of. I was afraid of people most of all. But I came close to bears that saw me, and mountain lions and rattlesnakes and all kinds of stuff. And normally I would have the dog with me. And so that might have been a deterrent, but I'm not sure. But I never had a problem. And I mean, I spent years and years by myself. Say my grandmother would say, I'm going to go off and take a hike up in the mountains there and follow the Indian trails. And I'd find the burial grounds and the creeks where the stones near the creek have been carved out so that they could make the cornmeal. I'd find arrowheads. I'd go down to the Air Force base, get as close as I could next to it, sit there and watch the T-33s and the F-86s take off. And later on, when they had the Super Savers, they would go Mach and then boom, boom. And I just loved all that. It was a magical place to be. In the country, especially next to an Air Force base like that, because everything that flew, jets and planes, and I had such a connection with. I just wanted to be around that always.
I was interested to read about your grandfather, and you had a connection with him as well, didn't you? Because he had experiences.
Grandfather Neil, yeah.
Well, he saw somebody in a churchyard, didn't he?
Yes. Yeah, and that was in Ireland, and he was taking his mother home, and the horse didn't want to pass the churchyard, which was very dark, and something was really disturbing the horse. And so he stopped, and he went in, and when he got in near the church, where the two parts of the building met, he saw in the corner a man sitting there, and he had like a trench coat on and a brimmed hat, and he had his head down, so he couldn't see his head, but he could see the feet. And he described him as being hooved. And he said it really scared him because he thought maybe he was looking at the devil. And then it looked at him, and it had these dark eyes and this face that he'll never forget. And he got the hell out of there. The scene in the film, if you've seen the film, that something is there. We did a movie. Based on the book, that scene is pretty accurately portrayed. So
And you had a sighting with him, didn't you? Was it the big red ball of light that came down?
Yeah. You know, that's in the film too. And yeah, it, and the film's on the channel, by the way. Yeah, it, you know, that's, and then when we went in afterwards and I was all excited and telling my grandmother about it, and she said, you saw a meteor. No, that wasn't a meteor. I mean, you know, I was a pretty smart kid. I was up on my astronomy and I was up on the difference between planets and galaxies, and I knew my sun was a star. It wasn't just the sun, like so many people commonly today think. They don't realize that that's a star. I knew the difference between a comet and a meteorite and a meteor descending through the atmosphere and burning up and disappearing as it cooled off. I knew all these things. So, but no, you saw a meteor, and your grandfather's crazy and he sees lots of things. And she'd joke about him seeing the leprechauns and the banshee and stuff, because he did describe those things, but he didn't use those terms. He said little people. He saw little people. And he heard the wail of some spirit when his mother had died, or someone in his family died. It couldn't have been his mother, because I actually met my great-grandmother. And she was she was very kind of Victorian and out of place in the late 50s when I met her. Still had the accent.
Was there a time when you saw, was it you got up and there was a visitor in the kitchen and he seemed to have hooved feet?
I think it was a she. I mean, I always think they're she's for some reason, but I just say she. Yeah, I just got up to get some water. And there was a butcher block parked right in front of the door that we had in the kitchen. And it was odd because I don't know why it's heavy. And I don't know why Jilly would have put it there, or her daughter Beth, because that was her daughter by another marriage. And it was just sitting there like that. And I thought, that's just so weird. And it started to move. And it startled me. And then once I was startled, then I saw the being standing there looking right at me. I think my mind was seeing it, but it couldn't believe what it was seeing. So it was going for the next possible thing it could be. And it was sort of tan, and so was the being. So maybe it was the wooden block, and my mind projected that. I don't know, or I don't think it was disguising itself. I think my mind was playing a trick on me. And when it moved, my brain said, wait a minute, you know, pieces of furniture don't move. So, and it just broke the spell, and I saw it for what it was, and it looked at me. It didn't look afraid or anything. It just sort of had this moment for a second there, and it just shot through the refrigerator. And I did my best to run into the living room, which is where it would have came out to see it, but I didn't see it. It wasn't there.
So when you say shot through the refrigerator, you mean it passed through matter? Not that it opened the door and jumped in or something.
Yeah, it was a blur. It just went straight through. And that didn't surprise me, because at that point I had been working with Yvonne for a while, and I knew that they could do that.
It's that thing though. What is it doing? What is it doing there? It wasn't there to see you, apparently. Maybe it makes you wonder, well, every night when I'm asleep, are they wandering around the house?
They may be. I've got a good sense of humor about this. They may be. I felt that if they didn't want me to see them, or she didn't want me to see her, that I wouldn't have. I think that the whole thing was very deliberate. Up to that point, seeing them had always been kind of a blur, something looking around the corner. And then, of course, we would do hypnosis. I would see the craft and very clearly, and I would, the blue lights coming through the windows, all that kind of stuff. But the memory of them was always sort of blocked. And so when we started doing hypnosis, I could see them quite clearly because I was getting my memories back, if we're to believe it. And I'm always cautious about that because we really don't know 100%. But I got the feeling that was done because I was still questioning it at that point. I had a number of sessions with Yvonne going back pretty far in my life. and brought forward some pretty amazing experiences, some pretty fantastic ones. And I got the feeling that they knew I was still questioning it. Well, I kept looking for that possibility that maybe it was something else. Maybe it was just my imagination and just being very vivid, or maybe I had some kind of mental condition. I stayed on the fence about it. But I felt that that was done so that I would see consciously, wide awake, there's one standing in front of me. No, we're real. And now, off it went.
Yeah. But that's something I always wonder about is, if you see a UFO, it's because they want you to see them. They're showing themselves to you. It's like when you were with your grandfather and you saw that red ball. It's not an accident. They wanted you to see it.
Yeah. I think so, because sometimes there'll be. I've had many witnesses with me, and they have. There's only one time that they didn't see what I saw, and that was with Chili, and she was as skeptic as it was. And this was long after she told me to leave and get out of this thing because it was scaring her so badly. She was convinced that somehow she was starting to see things because of me, and I was making them see things. She was in denial about it. So I was in the backyard of her house in Northridge, and I had been observing an object going over somewhat regularly over the backyard at night and heading towards the northeast. And so I got my binoculars out that night. It was much closer this time. And with the binoculars, you could see clearly it was a very hot white disc. Binoculars were really very well in focus, and it was a very hot white disc. And she came out and said, "What are you looking at?" And I said, "Well, I'm seeing something pretty unusual. Let me see it." So she kind of grabbed them out of my hands and looked at it. And she said, "That's just an airplane." I said, "No, it's not. That's not an aircraft. I know my aircraft. I've been involved in aviation and studying aircraft since I was a kid." I said, "And I know my aircraft. That's not." She says, "No, you don't know that. That's it." And she looked at it again. "It's an airplane." So I started to realize that she was probably seeing an airplane. But of course, the devil's advocate would say, "Well, you were seeing what you wanted to see."
Yeah. And talk about seeing things. You had two people, was it? They turned up on your doorstep and one of them looked a bit like David Jacobs and the woman looked like one of your neighbors or something?
Sure. Yeah. And I think I talked about it. She's even carrying a baby, but I don't know what happened to the baby when she got to the door. That was very odd. And that was during that time when my wife was doing the Renaissance Fair, and she did the Renaissance Fair for years. She, being a Brit, she really loved the Renaissance period. And she had a booth making trifle, real trifle, not the stuff they do over here. And she left. Normally she would leave on a Friday night. That time she left Saturday morning to go out and didn't spend the weekend. And she hadn't been gone very long. And I noticed through the window, living room windows, this car pull up. And I could see this woman sitting inside, and it looked like her friend that I knew. And she was wearing, a blue dress, and she had a baby. And then another car pulled up, and the guy got out with the white hair, and he did look like David Jacobs. And they started coming towards the house, and I thought, who are these people, And then they knocked on the door, and I opened up the door, and they're standing there, and I said, "Can I help you?" And the guy said, "You know who I am. You've read my books." And then they kind of pushed their way in. I mean, they took control of the moment, and I made no effort to resist them. I it wasn't there. And I remember they took me and they turned me around and started walking me back towards the bedroom. They laid me down on the bed face down and they pulled down my robe. And because I'm still in my night clothes, and I remember them putting their hands on my back, and I just lost consciousness. When I woke up, I was face down on the bed where they had left me, and they were gone. Now, it's possible that whoever this was, they used the imagery they did to deceive me into opening the door. Because I'm always cautious about opening the door if there's no one invited and somebody just drops by and I don't know who it is. It's really probably not the best idea to open the door to them. You communicate with them through the door, and if they don't answer you the correct way, you ask them to leave. And if they don't leave, then you call the police. Because people get shut, gunned down in their doorway all the time. And being that I was being threatened and being stalked during that period, that made me extra cautious. So,
and also, I read about you seeing a guy who was fixing your roof, and he was he was up there, but he was, there was no ladder.
Yeah, did I put that in the book? It's been a long time since I read the book.
Okay.
But you must have, because that must have been where it was. Yeah, it was very strange. I was in my shop. I had a beautiful shop attached to the house in Granada Hills. And I heard this noise. And I went out. And there's this guy. He's working on the roof. And I can still see his face very, very clearly. And he had short hair. And it was kind of a sandy brunette, slightly receding hairline. He had very pocked skin from bad acne at one time. And I would have placed him in his late 40s, and he had a moth-eaten sweatshirt on. It was literally moth-eaten. It was just so strange, and these old jeans on, and his feet were kicked forward, and I realized that there was nothing supporting him. There was no ladder or anything. It was just this really odd moment, and I just sort of looked at him, and I just said, "Hey, you're an alien," you know? Just like that just came out of me. And at that moment, he kind of lowered down, came over to me. And next thing I knew, I'm standing in front of this visitor, like in the kitchen. It was taller, very similar. And it just looked at me like, And I remember telling Whitley about this. I said, "Whitley, when it smiled at me, I could have sworn I saw teeth. There was something white in the mouth." He says, "Well, I've never seen teeth. They don't have teeth." I said, "Well, I don't know, because that's what I saw." And then it just started to spin, and it became like a dust devil, and it went through down the alley from me, through the fence that led to the street where I take the trash cans out, and I ran over to the gate and looked over and watched it just slowly get slower and slower and dissipate and just disappear in the street. Which is something I'm trying to reenact in the shows that I do, because I've done visual effects for so many years in film. And I'm one of the ones who did make a transition to 3D and worked in Lightwave and other 3D programs doing animation and creating wireframes and stuff. I made a really nice dust devil, and I have a whole transition of that. So I'm going to be able to show people what I saw. And I do that in all the shows that we do as best I can. I reenact, not with actors, but just what I saw from my POV, so they can get an idea of what it was like to witness things like this. It's nuts. It's just wacko. And you think you don't even want to tell people about it, but after reading the communion letters and Whitley's book and so many others that I read, I realized that I'm in no way alone with this.
I wanted to ask about Mr. Lee, who was the gardener when you were a kid, wasn't he?
And we never had a gardener. That's what my mom said. We never had a Chinese gardener. More appropriate to say Asian gardener, but because I didn't know he was Chinese, I was a kid. I assumed he was a Chinese gardener. The entire neighborhood had gardeners that were Asian. But he used to come in, and I'd be in the backyard playing, and we'd have these talks. And he knew a lot of things. I mean, he was kind of like a cross between Yoda and Einstein. But my memory of him in my mind, when I really see him, you know, he had this sort of green tinge to him almost, but I think that was coming from all the foliage in the backyard, because we lived in San Francisco and the backyard was, especially towards the end, would get quite wild and he'd come in and trim it. Now, I did that scene in the film, but it was never to my liking because I couldn't get the right actor to portray or the right location. But the essence of it was still there.
And he used to tell you things about how everything's all connected. It sounded kind of spiritual in a way.
Sure.
To do with consciousness.
Yeah, that you know, you're connected to everything around you and everything in the universe. And that's been a common theme with this experience. And if you've read Betty and Drazen's book, she accounts that one of the great creatures said that the problem with humanity is that it's separated. And that's all it said, which is very typical. They're great for one-liners, you know, they do it all the time. But when I was reading that, I knew what it meant. I mean, it's obvious. Look at this planet. At the rate forests are disappearing and the people here that are harvesting this world, humans, not aliens, humans harvesting it in the name of money and greed and power and domination, are doing the most horrible things that can be done. And they don't care. They don't have any feelings about it whatsoever. They see a bug, they step on it, you know? And yeah. I always try to respect the bug and talk to it and connect with it. And people thought I was crazy for doing that. And long before I ever said anything about having experiences with non-human intelligence. So, but that's what she meant. We disconnected from our very nature. And that's why we're going so terribly wrong.
There's so many questions here about that. And I've got a whole list of questions we haven't even touched yet from reading your book.
Right.
I wanted to ask you about...
Thank you for reading it. I appreciate it.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about was, I think you say that there was a craft over your back garden and this kind of cliche thing, maybe a beam of light came down and you were lifted up into the craft.
Yeah, sure.
But you say that, I'm just reading it now, there was an odd feeling like I had just entered another realm. And it seemed to me that you described the interior of the craft as being a lot bigger than it looked from outside.
Yes. Well, I did show recently about that. And I talked about that because I remember being pulled up. I remember seeing the light and it was in that same location that I saw the visitor come down from the roof and a lot of other things. And I was in my shop. I was always working on something for film, for another movie. And I went out to take the trash out. And which I always did. And that's when I encountered the two small Asian-looking ladies standing on my lawn trying to talk to me in a language I couldn't understand. They seemed confused. They certainly confused me. And I thought maybe we had neighbors that were Asian. I thought that maybe they just had the wrong address or something. And then one of them kind of pointed up and I started feeling uncomfortable. I think that other realm I started to feel right then and there. And so I left them kind of hastily and went to my gate and closed it. And I went back inside. And I remember turning around and looking. The door was open and I could see this pale sort of blue light beam there. It almost... Reflecting on it now, it had a like a sort of a thickness to it. And I don't know why, I walked out and I looked at it and I just decided to step into it. And the minute I did, I just felt weightless. And I just felt this feeling of being almost numb. And I slowly started going up. But then it gets, for me, it gets kind of dark there. I don't remember precisely what happened next. I do remember being inside something very small. And I remember two people sitting in front of me and a thing that looked like a trackball. And then I was on another craft or somewhere. It might have been a huge building. I don't know. But it was quite large, quite expansive inside, and seemed way too large to have been inside of the little craft that I was in. So I think it described it sort of as almost looking as a, like a flying car. And it came over the big tree in the backyard.
But wasn't you walking down the corridor with the visitors leading you along, and you could see all these rooms and all these other people?
Yes. Yeah. I saw that a lot. It's like a huge project. But what I talked about before, if many of us are not originally from here, and we were placed here in human lives to be, experiment's probably the wrong word for it. It's more like placed here to become human. And then we would be picked up from time to time, and our experience downloaded or somehow transferred to these beings, because they seem to be desperate to put themselves in touch with our emotions, as though they didn't have them themselves, as though they were lost. And maybe, and this is just a hunch on my part, that maybe in the long, long time that they have evolved over, both technically and amassing huge amounts of data and knowledge about the universe, maybe they just lost complete touch, couldn't feel anymore. And there are those who suggest that they feel they're de-evolving as a result. So they're really not a threat. They're really trying to get back something they lost. And one of the things I've noticed that they seem to focus on a lot is loss. It's not the hate emotion that they're interested in. It's not even the exhilaration of being happy. It's this loss, and it's hard to articulate, but it seems to me, the feeling I get is that when you lose someone, it could be your dog, which is your best friend. It's a terrible thing. I went through that 8 months ago. It was just awful. You know, I put her to sleep in my arms. It was just terrible. And they keep making me relive that. It's really hard, but I know what they're doing. At least I think I know what they're doing. And I think, you know, they know that my love was so strong for that animal that in feeling my loss, they can touch that. They can grasp why love is so important. And how, as human beings, will put themselves through anything for love, including having to put down your best friend in your arms, because that's a passionate act, especially when they're disabled and they're in pain, and that goes for humans and anything that's living that you love a great deal. I think somehow they've found that this puts them in the closest touch they can be with the strength of that love, because it's coupled to the loss. That's the best way I could articulate it. It's really hard. It was really hard losing Rosie. If I didn't have Nova, I'd be a basket case. She's only 5 years old. So, and I know it's coming with that one too, as I did with all of them, but it keeps me coming back. And they seem fascinated with it.
And do you talk to a lot of people in the UFO community?
I don't talk a lot to I'm in touch with a lot of people, like Whitley Strieber and Yvonne, and most of the community now knows about us. They remember me from the 90s because I was very prolific back then. I was on television all the time, on Sightings and Paranormal Borderline, all these talk shows. I was on with Whitley a lot and Roger Lear. And Yvonne, but a lot of these people remember me for back then. But I had to go silent because my wife wanted me to get out of it in 2000. And she passed away from breast cancer in 2013. And I just decided that there's nothing stopping me now. I can go back. It was stressing her out really she was scared to death by the whole thing. So, so I've been back at it slowly but surely. But now that we've done this channel, I've been hearing from other people. The community's talking about you. They're talking about you on Reddit. They're talking about it. So it's good. It's spreading, and hopefully the channel will grow. So because out of all the people doing channels about this subject, we're the only ones handling it the way we're doing the show. So it's a show made by someone that has the experiences for people who have the experiences to have a place, be able to tell their story. And as we say, break the silence. We're trying to get more people, the ones that are out there that are afraid to come forward, to come forward. Because one way we can have disclosure is if more people come forward, because it's got to be in the hundreds of thousands, if not more. And I think that the weight of their testimony, whether they use their own identities or voice or names or not, will make a difference. It seems to be already. So that was the whole point of breaking the silence. So,
all right. Well, thanks for coming on the podcast.
You're very welcome. I'm very glad to do it.
And that was an interview with Steve Neal about his book, But Something Is There. And a great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can get exclusive access to the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/AlienUFOPodcast. The extended episode is nearly 24 minutes longer. If you join the $2 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. And if you join the $5 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week. And when you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And if you want to try out the extended episodes, you can now get a 7-day free trial. And please check out my other podcast. It's called Our Paranormal Afterlife, and there are over 300 episodes. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the link is in the show notes. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review, and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening. And how widespread do you think this is? How many people are having these experiences?
Well, that's difficult to estimate, but judging by the amount of letters and people that have come forward, it's in the thousands easily. I mean, Anne read through 10,000 letters, and those are the people